Welcome to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Every week you'll find us right here on WEAA as we follow the stories that affect the lands and the communities of Delmarva. This week, join us as we take a look at the future of wind power off the Delmarva coast. Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar recently announced that the federal government will speed up the leasing process for offshore wind projects all along the Atlantic coast. And here in Maryland, advocates are asking legislative action that would ensure that utilities invest in wind power. We'll hear from two environmentalists with very different perspectives on wind energy. Up first, we'll hear from Mike Tidwell, founder and director of the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, a grassroots nonprofit dedicated to raising awareness about the impacts and solutions associated with global warming in Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C. Then we'll be joined by Ajax Eastman, the former president of the Maryland Conservation Council, who argues that wind power is not the clean energy boom that many are led to believe. First, let's get you home safe with WEAA traffic, and then we'll be right back with our conversation with Mike Tidwell. Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Up first, here's our interview with Chesapeake Climate Action Network founder and director, Mike Tidwell. I asked him about the conference on wind power that CCAN organized in Annapolis last weekend.
Over 300 people from across the state came together Saturday, December 4th, to show their support for moving forward on offshore wind power. You know, Mark, we've experienced, as you know, just unrecognizable weather in Maryland just in the last year. I mean, our weather has been extreme from, you know, record snowfall that broke all accumulation records in the Baltimore, D.C. area. Not record cold, mind you, but record moisture in the way that climate scientists say we should expect from more global warming. So we had record unrecognizable snow followed by enormous thunderstorms over the summer that knocked out power to 500,000 Marylanders. And then, of course, the heat, overwhelming heat, hottest summer on record in D.C. and Baltimore, most days over 90 degrees, highest average temperature for the summer. The point is this, we're experiencing extreme weather, clearly fitting the pattern of extreme climate change already, and therefore we need to move forward with extreme speed on the clean, renewable energy that will replace the fossil fuels that are causing this problem. And that's why you had just standing room only, packed audience on Saturday at the Westin Hotel in Annapolis, you know, a little bit more than a month before the Maryland General Assembly begins. You had speakers there from, you know, representing Google Inc., you know, partners with Google Inc. and investing in offshore wind transmission, electrical transmission. You had people from the offshore wind development companies. You had environmentalists. All the state's major environmental groups were unified in sponsoring this, by the way. You had the U.S. Steelworkers as an official sponsor, along with five of the state's biggest environmental groups, including my group, Chesapeake Climate Action Network. And then you had public leaders, like the majority leader in the House of Delegates, majority leader in the Maryland Senate. So a coming together of citizens, public leaders, business, labor, all calling for the same thing. It is time to tell the utilities in Maryland that we want them to invest directly in offshore wind development because it's the best way to develop the most clean energy quickly, given how quickly our climate is changing, and set an example for the rest of the nation and the world while maintaining all levels of environmental protection for birds, for marine life. So it's a win-win-win for everybody.
A couple of questions about that. I mean, there clearly have been some people who think the idea of wind is time has not yet come. This is too cumbersome a technology and too expensive and cumbersome a way for us to get energy. And let's talk about a few of those opposition points. John Boone, who is an environmentalist from Western Maryland and renowned for his opposition to wind energy, has said that if you look at places like Denmark that have all this wind, that most of the wind they have, they can't, because of transmission issues, they can't keep in Denmark, so they sell it to Sweden, and that the reality is their coal consumption is just as high as it ever was because wind can just not generate enough megawatts to combat the fossil fuels that we're trying to get away from.
Well, Just a quick point. John Boone is considered, you know, I respect his point of view. I respect his enthusiasm for what he believes in terms of being just dramatically anti-wind power in pretty much any fashion. But John is pretty much an outlier. He's considered a pretty part of a very small, extreme group of folks who also John Boone owns property in Western Maryland, and he's concerned about, you know, the real estate values. And the reality is we're not talking about onshore wind here. We're not talking about putting wind turbines near John Boone's house where he's clearly said he doesn't want them, sort of not in the backyard of my home, you know, NIMBY sort of stuff. We're talking about offshore wind power. And in terms of Denmark, they get a close to 25% of their electricity for the whole nation from wind power. There are states in northern Germany that get 40 to 50% of their electricity from wind power. So this works. This is not a sort of kind of maybe test, you know, theory. This is, there are 38 offshore wind farms in Europe right now, utility scale. We're talking about creating jobs in Maryland right now. We're talking about building offshore windmills 10 miles or more off the coast of Ocean City. They're going to be about the size of your thumbnail from the shore, and that's only in the winter when the air's really clear, the sky's clear. In the hazy summertime, you're not even going to be able to see them. There is no serious organized opposition to these offshore wind farms. I repeat, there is no serious organized opposition to these offshore wind farms in Maryland, Delaware, you name it. Delaware, the Delaware Audubon Society, biggest bird aviation group in the state, supports offshore wind. In Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Audubon Society, the largest conservation group in New England, biggest environmental group in England, Massachusetts Audubon Society, supports offshore wind. And in Maryland, you have the state's, other than if you take aside Chesapeake Bay Foundation, who hasn't weighed in yet, the other five largest environmental groups in the state, Sierra Club, Environment Maryland, Chesapeake Climate Action Network, League of Conservation Voters, and National Wildlife Federation, all support offshore wind. And tourism officials in Ocean City support it, and they said that the reason they support it is they believe more tourists will come to Ocean City to take, you know, eco trips out into the ocean to see the wind turbines themselves. So this is win-win-win. Now, in terms of bird impact, I mean, where is the data? I mean, the Europeans have data going back 20 years on aviation, interaction of birds with offshore wind turbines. No data whatsoever showing any impact whatsoever on bird populations in Europe. If they're properly located, and these in Maryland will be properly located, the Maryland Energy Administration is working with the U.S. Department of Interior. There will be an environmental impact study, all kinds of studies. We're going to put them in the right place. We're going to make sure there are no impacts on bird populations. They will actually create more marine life because they provide a kind of artificial coral out in the ocean. And lastly, it's going to create thousands and thousands of jobs, which is why the O'Malley administration is interested. The steelworkers support it. You're talking about at least 4,000 construction jobs to build a moderate-sized offshore wind farm, at least 800 permanent jobs from one wind farm. Once you get, you know, 3, 4, 5 wind farms out there, 10, 20 miles out to shore, you're talking about a serious increase in jobs for the state of Maryland. And I'll say this, there is no other industry, not one, no one can name another industry in Maryland that promises to create as many jobs as offshore wind power. No industry, not cars, our last automakers left, you know, you name it, no manufacturing, no major industry has the promise of thousands of jobs like offshore wind. So this is a serious coalition of environmentalists, labor, business, public leaders, and we're going to pass a bill in Annapolis in 2011 that's going to make this go faster. Because that's what we need. We're having extreme climate change. We need to move faster on things like this.
Some of the opposition that I've read, anyway, whether it's significant or not, argues that transmission's an issue in moving wind into the actual energy we use, A. And B, that Maryland, it's really very costly, and unless we can make a deal with the state of Delaware, if in fact it goes through, then making a deal with Delaware would be the only way to keep the transmission costs to a livable way.
Well, in terms of the cost, I mean, the good news really is that offshore wind power is very, very, very cost effective. In fact, it's over the next 25 years definitely going to be the most cost-effective form of utility-scale electricity generation in the state of Maryland. Why is that? Oil is going up, and we use a lot of oil to create electricity in Maryland. Unfortunately, the cost of oil is going up. We know about peak oil. We know that there's only so much oil in the world. Coal, the price of coal is fluctuating wildly and increasingly getting more expensive. And that's just the price. Of course, if we were to take into consideration the impacts of global warming from using coal to generate over half of our electricity in Maryland, huge impacts, sea level rise, property owners impacted, heat waves, you name it. So coal is extremely expensive on top of the fact that we blow the tops off mountains. We decapitate mountains to get it through mountaintop removal, including in western Maryland where mountaintop removal is happening. So coal, very, very expensive. Oil, very, very expensive. Nuclear, we all know the problems with nuclear, expensive, hazardous. You know, you reach a point where if you're talking about creating utility-scale power, electricity for the state of Maryland, offshore wind becomes the only viable option. Onshore wind, building wind turbines onshore in Maryland and western Maryland probably isn't going to happen on a large scale. There are concerns about impacts to viewscapes and other concerns about putting wind turbines on land, which is why the push really is now to do it offshore. And the thing is, if you take into consideration the fact that our electricity bills have gone up 70% in Maryland just in the last decade because of fluctuating fossil fuel prices and other factors, you're looking at something that can be locked in. Offshore wind power, the developers can tell you right now, the wind power will be a little bit more expensive than coal in the early years, mm-hmm. but over the 25-year period, they can lock in the price for 25 years. Why? Because the fuel for an offshore wind farm is free. It's wind. There are no fuel costs, unlike an oil-burning power plant, a coal-burning power plant, where you have to build the plant, then you have to pay for fuel for the whole lifetime of the plant. With wind power, you just pay to build the wind turbines up front, and then the fuel is free for the next 25 years. So you can lock in a price now. For example, if I were to tell you, you could get coal-fired electricity for, let's say, $5 a unit. Let's just say $5 a unit. For the next year, okay? Or you could get wind-powered electricity for $6 a unit for the next 25 years guaranteed. $6, not going to go up. Which would be more reasonable? It would be the wind power, because we know the coal is going to go up over time. So the wind developers need a long-term contract. They can guarantee a price for 25 years, and we need to require utilities to enter into these long-term contracts for at least, let's say, 5 to 7% of the state's electricity. This is what Delaware has done. This is what Massachusetts has done. If you leave the utilities to themselves, they will only burn coal. They will only burn oil. They will only consider short-term impacts. They sign 1 to 2 year contracts for coal and oil. They don't want to sign long-term contracts because it's not what they do. They're not feeders on wind power. It takes the citizens, public policy, to lead the utilities toward a more enlightened outlook. And so, yes, offshore wind power may be slightly more expensive in the early years, but over the long term, especially as Congress ultimately puts a price on carbon because of global warming, which we know they will do, there will be a tax on carbon fuels in the future. Might not be next year, but it's going to happen in the next 5 years. All of that makes offshore wind more and more cost-effective. And we haven't even talked about the avoided impacts on human health. Wind power has no pollution. Delaware alone said that if you built one moderate-sized wind farm off the coast of Delaware, you would avoid 200 premature deaths from asthma, cancer, and the other impacts of using dirty energy. And you would save the state $1 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion in health costs. From dirty energy. So it is clear that offshore wind power is the most cost-effective, the most economically rational, and the most environmentally sound way to go.
Now, you may be more optimistic than I about whether or not we'll have a significant carbon tax in the near future. I'd like to see it, but I'm not so sure we're going to see it, given the power of oil and coal in their lobbying efforts and the amount of money they spend with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce to lobby our senators and congressmen on Capitol Hill.
Well, it may not happen immediately, but it's going to happen. The idea that we could continue to watch the Greenland ice sheet completely disappear and start looking at a foot of sea level rise in downtown Annapolis and never do anything, just we never do anything about it as a nation, I think is highly unlikely. The problem is we are letting the impact deepen. We are letting global warming accelerate much faster than we have to. But eventually we're going to take a stand, and we're going to put some kind of tax, some kind of cap on carbon fuels. I mean, that's inevitable. Even the utilities say that. Even the coal companies say it's inevitable that there's going to be some kind of cap on carbon emissions. We just need to make it happen sooner or later. But in the meantime, in Maryland, we can go ahead and move forward with a rational, environmentally sensitive, and job-creating promotion of offshore wind.
I'm curious, A, if we were to maximize the transmission capability, and how much would that cost, and this up front? And B, even if that happened, given that the intermittence of wind energy, of the creation of wind energy, what percentage of our energy resources could come from wind, and how reliable would that be?
There have been several studies that address the exact question that you asked. And first of all, Denmark does get close to 25% of its total electricity generation is from wind power right now. That is a fact. So wind can be generated on a large scale within the current grid system. Now, if you get past that 20 to 25%, you do start to run into the issues of, as you said, intermittency. The wind is not blowing all the time, and therefore, how are you going to make this work? So there are lots of different approaches. The biggest need is for a regional wind grid. In other words, we need to connect New Jersey, Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, the District of Columbia in a smart grid, Pennsylvania, that allows for wind to be, harnessed offshore wherever the wind is blowing and distributed evenly. So at any one point between New Jersey and Virginia, there's a weather front moving through that latitude somewhere. You're talking about, hundreds of miles. And if you have windmills spinning in one part of that latitude and not in the other, but you have a grid that evens out the flow and distributes it evenly to the states, then you can start to get beyond 25% of your electricity from wind power. But the best studies that have come from University of Delaware, Stanford University, and others is that as a region, and by that I mean New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Virginia, with a smart grid that integrates this, that we could get about a third of our electricity just from offshore wind. Now, that's going to take some time. We're going to have to take some steps. We've got to build those first few wind farms. We need to create an offshore grid that connects them. But, this is how we built, all of our infrastructure in this country, whether it be electrical, whether it be transportation, the metro system in D.C. It doesn't just happen at one time. It begins with first step followed by second step. It includes a vision. It includes a determination that we're going to change the way we live. We're heading in a certain direction. And then we build the infrastructure and we take the steps. But you can't get there without a first step. And America does not have a offshore wind farm yet. It looks like the Cape Wind Project in Massachusetts is definitely permitted. They now have financing. They're moving forward. Delaware's moving forward, again, with the blessing of the Audubon Society and others, tourism people, Chamber of Commerce, labor unions, and now Maryland is going to move forward. But Maryland really needs the General Assembly to simply pass a law that tells the utilities, again, you need to get maybe 5 to 7% of your electricity from these long-term contracts that make offshore wind power happen. And I think the governor agrees with that. His top energy advisors have said that the governor believes that that is an important way to go. You've got Kumar Barve, the leader of the Maryland House of Delegates, majority leader who supports it. Rob Caragiola, the new majority leader in the Senate who supports it. So the utilities just need to be nudged in the right direction, sign these long-term contracts that create price stability over time and are cost-effective.
So it was interesting you said about off the Cape project. So despite fellow environmentalist Robert Kennedy's opposition, it's going to go forward.
Well, Robert Kennedy, first of all, most of the Kennedys who were previously opposed are now in support. Walter Cronkite, who was previously opposed in Nantucket Sound, is now in support. Again, I, You can find individuals who okay, so you really like solar power. I can find an individual who will tell you that solar's bad and will lay out all the reasons why, you know, there's all kinds of problems with solar and you gotta make glass and, you know, things break and there's a small amount of, you know, some hazardous chemical involved. I mean, you can find somebody that opposes everything. But the Massachusetts Audubon Society, again, the largest environmental group in New England, supports the Cape Wind offshore wind project. That reassures me. I'm a lifelong birder. I've been birding all my life. I fight global warming in order to preserve birds so that my 13-year-old son can be a birder when he's my age. And when I saw that Massachusetts Audubon supported the offshore wind farm in Massachusetts, I became a very strong supporter as well because they know what they're talking about. They have a 100-year reputation of preserving birds. Massachusetts Audubon Society would not support this offshore wind farm. I assure you, if they weren't convinced that it was good for the environment.
The political effort to get Maryland to get behind the construction of wind turbines out in the Atlantic Ocean on federal property, correct? The federal end, not
it's federal waters. Yes.
Even if that happened, though, I guess one of the things I'm pulling out from what you're saying is that this can't really be as effective as it needs to be, unless this is both regional and national.
This offshore wind grid doesn't have to be national in scale, but yes, it is a regional effort. It is, you know, Maryland can't efficiently can't generate 25% of its electricity for the state or more completely by itself. Efficiency, you know, economies of scale require or suggest that a more regional approach would make sense. And the good news is that Delaware is moving forward with offshore wind. New Jersey has passed a legislation that encourages offshore wind. Maryland's about to do it. Google Inc. is about to invest billions of dollars in an offshore transmission system. And at our conference on December 4th in Annapolis, there was a representative from that investment group, Robert Mitchell, of a group called TransElect, based in Bethesda, blew the audience away with his description of how they can use underwater cables to transmit the electricity from windmills from one state to the other in a way that's going to be very cost-effective and that's going to change the way the whole East Coast uses electricity. So it needs to be regional. That doesn't mean that Maryland can't go ahead and take some state-based policy approaches now. But ultimately, yes, you're going to talk about an integrated clean energy grid from Massachusetts to North Carolina.
So if we started today to build these transmission lines underwater, to build the transmission lines on land, to build these wind turbines out in the federal waters of the Atlantic Ocean, what do you think? How long do you think it takes from start to finish? And then when it happens, what would be the result?
Well, we could move very, very quickly with improved and federal permitting processes and with investments that Google's talking about. I think you could see some very serious wind development off the mid-Atlantic coast within 5 years. That's fully constructed up and running. Cape Wind will probably be built sooner than that in Massachusetts, but I think 5 years is what is realistically the time frame that we're talking about for a pretty significant installation of these windmills.
And you think that would end? That theoretically we could have 25% of our energy coming from wind in the United States. I mean, in the East Coast.
Yeah, not within 5 years, but within 10 to 15 years, absolutely, absolutely, yes. I mean, again, the parts of Europe are already doing that. I mean, Denmark built the first offshore wind farm in the world in 1991. It's been creating electricity for 20 years. This is not a new technology. This is proven technology. It can be done. It has been done. It's been done for 20 years already. So it's just a matter of, is America ready to go? Congress, you know, we know is in its own special form of gridlock, and it's up to the states. You know, the states like California and Minnesota and the New England states and Maryland, who've been leading on clean energy for the last 10 to 20 years, it's time for the next step. And the next step in terms of generating clean, renewable energy is offshore wind. And all we're going to do is use the technology the Europeans have already developed and deployed and now build it here using Maryland steelworkers, you know, by making as many of the component parts as we can here, creating jobs, and it's time to move forward.
I was just sent an email. It was from the guest column in the Capital Gazette, I suppose, by Alex Pavlak. And this is what this argument says. It was just literally as I'm sitting here talking to you, it just popped up. So it's almost fortuitous here. So let's see what this says. It says that basically it's saying it is remarkable that Maryland has proceeded on this wind plan and accelerating the lease process from the Department of Interior without a benefit cost assessment. That it said, even though the whole point is to reduce electric power system emissions, there's been no evaluation of the impact of the wind farm on electric power system, CO2, SO2 emissions, and nitrogen oxide emissions. And there's no evaluation of a system-wide cost. How much will Maryland offshore wind increase our bills? And there's no comparison of other choices for reducing CO2 emissions, like replacing coal with natural gas and building additional nuclear reactors at Calvert Cliffs. So I'm going to look at this while you're answering that. So what would your
just said, if you're quoting this individual, he's frankly just completely uninformed. And I would encourage him and other listeners, if you really want to learn what's happening in terms of offshore wind power, the Environment Maryland has a wonderful report that they put out about a year ago. Can just go to environmentmaryland.org. Delaware, University of Delaware, Stanford University. You can Google Stanford and Delaware 2007 study. Able Foundation in Baltimore, ABELL. Able Foundation did a study last February on the cost effectiveness and environmental protections involving offshore wind power. How it's, you know, dramatic. Of course, better than coal. Coal is devastating the state of Maryland, devastating birds, devastating mountains, giving kids asthma, costing us a fortune, and virtually bankrupting our state by providing over half of our electricity. Wind power, is it perfect? Are people looking for the absolute perfect, just it's virtually free, we don't have to look at it, it doesn't affect even a single moth or cricket? I mean, there is no such thing as a perfect energy system. There isn't. Is wind power absolutely, totally perfect and free and a paradise of energy? No. But it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be a lot better than coal. And wind power is so much better than coal. We get half of our electricity from taking the tops off of mountains, including in Maryland, giving kids asthma and causing 30 feet of potential sea level rise. We have to do better than that. The best energy source on a large scale that fights global warming, is cost-effective, prevents kids from getting asthma, is offshore wind power. And I wouldn't support it if I didn't believe that that was true. And it's going to be good for our utility rates over time. It's good for our children, and it makes sense.
Mike Tidwell, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you once again.
Hey, Mark. Thanks for having me on your show.
And we look forward to doing more of this. Thank you. That was Chesapeake Climate Action Network founder and director Mike Tidwell. Stay with us, because right after the short break, we'll hear from Ajax Eastman, an environmental advocate who doesn't see wind as a green solution for our energy needs.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Up next, we'll hear from Ajax Eastman. She's been an environmental activist and consultant in Maryland for over 35 years, and she believes that wind power is often falsely presented as green energy without any downsides. So Ajax Eastman is with us. She is an environmental activist. She's past president of the Maryland Conservation Council. I have known her and of her for at least the last 18 years. And Ajax, good to see you. Welcome to the studios.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So this is interesting that you and a handful of others, really,
right,
in the environmental movement oppose wind power.
Yes.
And I think that people went, what? Well, what do you mean you were postman power?
Well, my initiation was in Western Maryland because we established a number of wild lands out there, and I know the land in the mountains, the Appalachian Ridges. And when the first three proposals for projects out there came on board, when several others became interveners. And my original objection was based on Chan Robbins, the great, well-known authority on birds and things. He's done studies out there for 50 years. His problem with wind on the Appalachian Ridges is he's done all these studies on breeding birds and everything. He knows the territory, and it's a major migration corridor. So my objection was that they were going to put these turbines in the way of these migrating birds. Well, it turns out not only birds, but bats in particular have been victims of it. But it's not only then, you know, since I got involved initially, I've learned a lot more about the industry and the fact that it takes up an enormous amount of land. Doesn't look like it is, but in order to create enough electricity, it doesn't have a high capacity value. In other words, if a turbine is 100% of its capacity for producing energy, that's the nameplate capacity, but it only produces in Western Maryland, it only produces 30% of that capacity on the average. And then in the summertime, when the demand for energy is the highest, it falls to 10% because of the intermittency of wind. And it's not only true in Western Maryland, but also this great area off the coast that they say, which is, has more potential for wind. But even at that, offshore, the capacity is only 40% of its nameplate value. So you need a lot of turbines in order to produce enough energy to have any kind of meaning or, you know, ability to feed the grid. Now, 60% of the time when it isn't producing wind on a regular basis, then it has to have a backup in order to feed the grid for the electrical demand. So 40% summertime offshore drops to 25% sometimes. So it's not most people, I mean, the people that are promoting wind, the industry, the government, and people like Mike Tidwell and his group and all the other environmental groups in Maryland, it seems almost, except for Maryland Ornithological Society, are pushing wind without talking about the true value. They're overestimating what value they have. On the other hand, they're also underestimating, or they're not talking about, the true costs of producing this energy. And the problem is that they don't talk about all the subsidies that they're getting from the federal government, from the state government, from the local people. It's enormous.
Well, you said a lot. Let me kind of parse some of the stuff out.
And
jump in with anything you think you forgot in the process.
Okay.
I mean, the I know the Maryland Ornithological Society, which my mother was a proud member for many years.
Oh, good.
Was I,
yeah.
Is opposed to this, but the Audubon societies do not here, nor in off Cape Cod. I mean, they were part of the
Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania Audubon is very much against it. They're the ones that are faced with all the turbines that are going up.
The reports, at least I've read, and I've been trying to read as much as I can here, kind of say that the bird kill is really much more minimal than people are saying.
Except the raptors. You know, the raptors are affected, particularly in Western United States, but also they're putting them where there's raptor corridors too, which is another thing. But the big problem is the bats, and it's not the turbine blades that are killing them. It's the fact that when they get near it, there's something in it that blows out their lungs. So there's no scarring on them when they pick them up from, you know, around the base. But the one in Mountaineer in West Virginia, they found one night or overnight about 4,000 bats that were killed. Now, you know, the bats are also suffering from the white nose syndrome, which is killing them all off. So putting up all these turbines where the bats are and where their you know, their migration corridor is, kind of probably kill off the ones that don't get killed by the white nose syndrome. But that's not the main reason. Okay. I'm really upset about the fact that they don't disclose a lot. That's pretty well known that they kill birds and bats. But, yeah, okay, maybe not so many birds, but, yeah, they minimize the number, too.
So when I read about, I've heard both different stories they say about the other countries that use wind at the moment, mm-hmm. but places like
Denmark, it has the most.
And other nations in Northern Europe are fueling up to a quarter of their needs by wind.
But they haven't closed down one coal plant.
They've not done that, but they're still.
No.
But that.
You know why? Because they have to have backup when they aren't working, when they aren't spinning. They have to have energy. So, you know, Denmark is using hydro from Sweden, I think. Yeah. Okay. But still, even with hydro from Sweden, they haven't closed down any of the coal plants because it's needed to keep the energy demand on board.
But energy can be stored.
How?
They store it on the grid and they pass it on to you?
No. They can't store it on the grid. The grid takes it when it comes in and it puts it out where it distributes it where it's needed. They're working on, one of the suggestions is that they have thousands of hybrid cars that plug in and store it that way. That's not going to come on for a long time.
Well, and neither would wind either. I mean, whether you're building a nuclear plant, which some would say is the way we should go, and others would disagree.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you want to see the difference?
And the others would say that wind, they're going to take time to build the turbines as they would anything else.
Yeah. I mean, in order to equal the amount of electrical energy produced by a nuclear, say, Calvert Cliffs 3, when it's built, if it's built, you would need 1,200 turbines to equal that amount of capacity. And the footprint. The footprint, 400 acres for a nuclear facility, and you're talking about one up in New Jersey that we went up to testify for. That one would take 15 times the size, the mileage, square miles of Newark, New Jersey, to equal the amount of energy put out by that nuclear facility. So you're talking about a footprint that's absolutely enormous to produce reliable. The trouble with wind is it's intermittent. Even out in the ocean, where Tidwell talks about all the, the best at wind and wherever, there was a study done for 5 years. They put out from Maine to the Keys. They had these meteorological wind testing facilities, mm-hmm. about 11 of them. Mm-hmm. And this is even from the Delaware group that are pushing wind industry, the university. If you interpret the results of that, it would show, well, first of all, the turbines don't start moving until the wind is at 16 miles per hour. It gets to 67. This is for 5 megawatts, and I don't think that's what they're building out there now. But anyway,
much larger.
Not larger than 5 megawatts. Megawatts is large. I think they're building smaller. But anyway, they may be doing 5. But anyway, it cuts off when it reaches 67 miles an hour. That's another thing. People don't realize that it has to be between those two markers. But extrapolating what they had on their graph, the reaching the capacity, the nameplate capacity of those things, would only reach the capacity something like 3 days of the year, the 90% or 100% capacity. And even if it was 80% capacity, it would be like seven weeks, I think it is, or something like that. So even the wind out there is not as stable, because even they were thinking that if they had turbines from Maine to the Keys, that the wind somewhere along that line, there would be wind available.
Right.
But if you interpret the graphs that they have, that's not really the way it's going to, they aren't going to reach their capacity because it doesn't happen that way.
What do you mean it doesn't happen that way?
It doesn't, it isn't always blowing somewhere where it isn't blowing someplace else. Okay.
Well, not always, but the, but I thought that most.
But so it doesn't really it doesn't have the capacity.
But even some of the studies I've been reading have said that system could work if there was a regional national system along the coasts, that it would be blowing somewhere, and wind would be generating at some point somewhere on the East Coast all the time, most of the time.
But the collection of the data doesn't really confirm that. It doesn't. I should have brought the graphs in for you so you could see.
I mean, when I was reading the report locally from the Center for Integrative Environmental Research at Maryland, I mean, they raised some issues about why this could be difficult, but they thought in the long run that it would generate 25 or more percent of our energy in this Mid-Atlantic region.
It's not going to work.
So why will it not work?
Because
if it's integrated into other systems, integrated into a solar system along with wind system, and we have to start somewhere.
Well, again, solar. If you're talking industrial solar, it takes a lot of space. The wind doesn't blow all the time. The sun doesn't shine all the time, especially in this part of the country. So solar again is going to be the most expensive. Wind is the next expensive, and I think it really ought to talk about the subsidies, because for an industry that is being promoted as being clean, green, and free, of course, everything else is free. The sun's free. The coal's free. It's in the ground. It's what it takes to build all the turbines to make them, take the coal out of the ground or whatever. But when you look at it all, How much CO2 is it going to? They keep talking about it's going to reduce the CO2, but it isn't, because of the intermittency and what they have to bring on board to provide the steady flow is probably going to be gas or coal. So you're not saving all that much carbon dioxide.
It may be more expensive, but the people are also arguing that, I mean, let's say if you had wind on the shores, if you had solar that was, as one plan I saw, that somebody had designed, that had the solar grid, the solar panels on either side of the right-of-way in the entire grid in the United States of America, it may be expensive in the beginning, but the volume of it itself, costs go down over the years, and it could then generate energy almost on a consistent basis around the country and on the coast combined. It would cost money if you don't subsidize it. If we didn't subsidize oil, we couldn't afford the oil we use.
Yeah, but we're talking about subsidies up to 50% and probably more. If they turn, they've got tax breaks, they've got, the subsidies are unbelievable.
But let me ask this question about the subsidy. I mean, that's what we do with the oil companies now, and coal, and gas.
Not 50% of their investment.
If you combine everything oil gets with their tax write-offs, their subsidies, mm-hmm. what they get back from the government, it's very close. And the byproduct of that is destroying us.
Yeah, okay. Wind has taken up a lot of land, a lot of water, a lot of... we don't know anything about the floor of the oceans. Do they want to put these things on? We don't. It's in the migration path of the right whales. 400 of them left. They're endangered species. We don't know any. We know more about the surface of Mars than we do of the ocean floor.
It's very true.
That's right. So we're doing this, and we're going to. And Salazar says we're going to expedite the permits. So
for the wind, for wind,
for wind. Yeah.
Right, right.
Yeah. And so where's the environmental review going to come in?
So what do you do then? I mean,
what do you do?
Yeah.
Well,
we are facing a crisis in the world. So what do we do?
Well, I say we build some more nuclear plants because it takes less whatever. It takes more. It takes up less room. It's 90% efficient all the time. All the time. This is the big problem with wind. It isn't. It's intermittent. It's not a baseload kind of energy supply for the grid. Okay?
So what about the issue of spent fuel, of where those rods go, of the...
You need a trip down to Calvert Cliffs
to
see.
I've been to Calvert Cliffs, but I mean...
Where the storage is.
But it's still... But most switches, look, everything seems to have some trade-off here.
Yeah.
And
everybody's scared of nuclear because it's going to cause all kinds of problems, radiation, and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
Yeah, I get more radiation at 18,000 feet when I climb up in Nepal than you'd ever get living around a nuclear facility.
So far as we know. But there are a lot
of people. Well, now that's true. And so,
as far as we know.
And there's a fellow who I know who's... does the nuclear refueling of the submarines. And I get more up there than people in the submarines do. So, you know, the fear of nuclear is just really ridiculous. But it's because of Three Mile Island, the China Syndrome, everybody thinks it's... I mean, I was an opponent of nuclear until I learned more about it from people who have worked with nuclear stuff.
So some of the arguments about... one of the things you just made as well about nuclear power, they're also getting subsidies.
Not nearly what wind is.
Not nearly, but they're getting a lot of subsidies, and it is not. They may not get 50%, but also from. But let me just ask this question. Also from our because I'm in some ways I'm a little agnostic on all this. Okay, but from what I've read, is that even if it doesn't amount to 50%, or whatever that argument might be, the actual cost will be just as great.
Costs will be great. But the private people will pay for it more than the investment from the private industries into wind is not going to be there without the huge
subsidies.
They're
getting a lot of write-offs asking for a lot of things if they build these plants in America.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, you're not going to get away from the subsidies nor from giving large corporations lots of money no matter what you do.
Well, they're loans and they're not outright grants like they're giving wind.
That I'm not so sure about.
Well, there was a letter from, I don't know if you saw the article in the Wall Street Journal from... Summers, who's retiring from...
Yes, I did see that.
You did see that?
I did see
okay.
That.
Yep. So DOE's wanting to take the stimulus money for energy for wind and turn it into outright grants instead. And the point is that we would be paying more than 50%. The taxpayer would be, not the private enterprise people. The taxpayers would be paying that much for it. And they could write off those things
I guess what I'm saying, Ajax, whether you like nuclear power versus wind or not, I think that we get it in the butt no matter what gets built, because private industry is going to and government will collude to take it out of our hide no matter which energy source we use.
Well, not so much with the nuclear.
I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think when we have this conversation, I'll show you the chart itself, that what they're getting from the government and the concessions they're getting from the government are huge. To say they're not, I don't think is factual.
Well, I think they match the wind one.
Because
they will go ahead and they'll eventually go ahead and build them anyway, but wind would never do it.
No, exactly.
Well, what they want is the loan guarantees in case there's a big problem with, you know, people lying down on the ground and, you know, delaying it and all the rest of the stuff like they've had and up in Scandinavia.
So this is, but let's get back to this. So the idea that the imprint of nuclear power would be less.
Yes.
You think it would be safer in the long run?
I think it's safe. I don't know. You know, there's a lot of we're talking inshore, offshore, onshore, offshore.
Yeah.
Onshore, a lot of failures with the turbines, you know. Blades falling off, hitting houses, a lot of health effects, so they're really bad with it.
Health effects with wind?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
You don't know about the health effects of wind?
Tell me, I don't want to hear. Tell our listeners about these health effects.
Okay, well, if you live near a turbine, and a lot of places allow them to be sited too close to where people live, and where people live, the real estate values go down like this. It has a noise, a constant noise.
Has a hum.
Constant noise that is it's bad on the health. I know I was on the health noise, helped to get the noise regulations in Maryland many years ago.
I know that
noise is bad. It gets your adrenaline going. It gets your heart going. It gets, you know, overtime, and when it's constant. People that live near these things, and then there's the strobe effect. They and I, you know, the blade's going, and it reflects through the house. It's a very, very disturbing thing.
So if...
Yeah.
If most of the nuclear industry and is related in many ways financially to oil and to gas and those industries.
Maybe more so than wind, I don't know.
Well, let's talk about that. So why do you think it's wind they were being sold a bill of goods on? How would be?
Because I think it's a collusion between the industry, the promoters, the government that's giving all the subsidies and promoting it, from the president on down. It's just being without people really realizing all the overestimation of the values and the underestimation of the cost, as that says. But another issue is the nuclear facilities are near the transmission lines now. You talk about wind has to be where the wind is, which is not usually near the big population centers, so you need more transmission lines. Mm-hmm. You lose some of the energy in the transmission. You know, you're destroying the area in Western Maryland where they're putting these things. Okay. Synergix, owned by Wayne Rogers, who's a former head of the Democratic Committee in Maryland,
oh, yes.
Et cetera.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
Okay. He had a proposal for his Synergix company that was going to put up a number of turbines on Backbone Mountain, just over the border from the Mountaineer in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is back when... the Department of Natural Resources wanted to exclude a number of, you know, ones, maybe if he had 20, there were 25 or whatever number of turbines. They said this number is in endangered species or threatened species area. And so the Public Service Commission removed them from his, project. He was really furious because he couldn't put up the number that he wanted. So what does he do? He turns around with his buddies in the Department of Natural Resources and the legislature, and he gets them to pass a law that says under 70 megawatts there will be no environmental review. Okay? So then a year or so later, he applies again, and what does he do? He gets a permit for all those ones that he wanted in the first place. That are on, you know, the threatened area. Okay, so what we're talking about on the Appalachian Ridges is unfragmented forest. It has terrestrial endangered species or, you know, threatened species, avian ones, et cetera. So you punch all these holes in there. In the unfragmented forest, you're removing habitat for wood rats and snakes and all kinds of terrestrial things. And then you're also... where birds, migrating birds have nesting areas and things like that. And they require unfragmented forests. They don't do well where there's openings like for these turbines and things like that because they need interior forest, which is what this is. So you talk about from Maine to Georgia covering the whole Appalachian Ridges. That doesn't have the amount of wind that really produces a reliable source of energy. Why are we doing that? Because the industry is going to profit from it and can write it off in 3 to 5 years. And we end up paying for it. You know, mostly it's not a good deal. And most people don't realize all those facts and figures and things like that. It is bad.
This has been fascinating. I've always appreciated, I must tell you, your the forcefulness and intellectual rigor that you bring to everything I've known you fight for over these last 18 years.
I've done a lot of fighting, believe me.
And it's a pleasure to have you in the studio again. But this is just chapter one. We'd love to have you back for chapter 2, 3, 4, and 5 as this thing gets debated and we look at it. Hey, Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mark.
That was environmental advocate Ajax Eastman. Thank you for joining us for this week's episode of On Delmarva. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media.
Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.